touch me.
That is funny. That is funny. Okay, everyone, we're live. Great to see everybody today. Welcome back from Easter. Hope everyone had a good little break or time with family. So here today with Jacqueline Arnest. Jacqueline is an executive in the multifamily side of things with tons of experience both nationally, regionally, and of course globally with respect to marketing brand and driving sales. So a fun conversation to be had today. We first connected through Ian Bingham at NMHC in person, and then subsequently over a couple different calls, get a chance to get to know each other, and especially what you're working on these days. I think that one of the things that we really connected on is on this conversation around brand promise and brand, and how that all connects to how we deliver, and how that cascades right through to operations and measurement, and then recurring revenue. Had a great kinds of conversations around that, so that's exciting to kind of carry through on our initial conversations that kicked off. So for everyone logging in today or listening today, getting to Hell Yes, this conversation is something that we started way back in the fall, and now we're coming up on our 100th conversation. Uh-huh. And what's really exciting about this evolution is really listening to everyone in the market, and everyone is compelled to respond to how the modern buyer chooses. And the modern buyer, they may know more about your business than you do by the time you end up going to have that conversation. And so they prioritize their problem solving. They've expressed their issue in their own language, and they're looking to find to solve problems. They've looked in GPT, they've looked in Google, they've looked everywhere. And so it's up to us as sellers to respond to them rather than try and, persuade them. And, that sounds a little bit easier than it appears when we go and deploy that in tactical. Because we got to make sure we find them when they're ready to buy, and that's difficult. And so these conversations, we end up talking a lot about that. So everyone that's listening today, feel free to ask questions on the chat as we're going throughout. This is brought to you by IRCX. We're a remote maintenance software for property management, and we're looking forward to having this conversation. Now, as we started off, Jacqueline, a little bit about yourself and what's the problem you're solving today, these days?
Sure. Well, the problem I'm solving, as many of you do know, I am on what Gen Z is calling a micro retirement. So right. The best thing about this conversation today is there is absolutely no agenda other than to have a great conversation. So my micro retirement is something that I've been doing for a while and throughout my career. And so I love that Gen Z is embracing it. But it's essentially after a high volume role, high productivity. This specific last one was creating Article Student Living. Once that chapter is closing, because of I'm leading marketing and communications, I'm building the brand, emulating the brand, training the brand, and then I have to, at the end of that experience, close that chapter and prepare myself for the next company that we create. So that is my micro retirement, but I started in leasing and I worked my way up. I built a few vendor companies and eventually landed and decided that the operating company is the best fit for me.
Wow. Now that's exciting. I do like the language you're using around creating a company. So yes. With Article specifically, was it, I don't know the detailed history of the company. It was started up from scratch with you and the leadership?
Yeah, it was previously a 50-50 partnership. So mm-hmm. When the sale occurred with QuadReal, we had 60 to 90 days to create a brand from naming convention to website go live, all the way through how the leaders were going to emulate the brand and train the brand throughout the whole organization. Which, when you're talking brand, right, it's not just a logo, a color palette, even the visual scape. It truly comes back to that experience of how people are going to feel when they lease with you, when they work mm-hmm. with you, when they invest with you. So the language is very in-depth. Usually the projects end up being 12 to 18 months, but we escalated it. Absolutely incredible team. Could not be more grateful for the experience. And then at that year mark, a little over the year mark, as we had a new leadership team come in, that is when my role was done and I'm decompressing and ready for whatever's next.
I mean, it's a natural stabilization period, right? Where you Beautiful. Play your yes. strengths and do those sort of things and operate. I mean, I wouldn't say like stabilization operators come in instead of startup operators come in, right? And they focus on different things. And the work really is to tune and not to create at that point in time.
Correct, right? At that point, you're minimizing change or you're preparing for high volume. So you're really evaluating at that time and creating a strategic plan for the go moment.
So one of the things about brand, and I had Tony Souza on last week, we're chatting a bunch about brand, and I love the concept of brand.
Great session.
Oh, thanks for coming, John, for listening in.
Yes, I did.
He's a blast. He's a blast. And, you know, I'm a particularly like fond of brand because it sounds magical, right? What it can do and how it can create value. And I think we wrote an article, this is probably 15, 18 years ago, around like the value of a brand versus the net book value of an asset. So you look at like, just quantitatively, look at the market capitalization of like Apple versus the net book value of all their assets. Argue it one way or not, that gap is brand.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. And so think of the multiple on brand. When you take a look at net book value of assets times, and especially for management companies whose assets are really kind of like profits. It's not really hard assets or it's typically not that much IP related. And so you take a look at those sort of things and think of the value of brand. There is a hard business case to focus on brand. But then we hear all the time in multifamily that brand is just starting to emerge. Like, what's your take on that?
Well, it has to be the relevance of your customer and understanding of your base, right? Because your company brand may be irrelevant, but your flagship brand or your property brands may have more impact. Mm-hmm. Your family of companies brand may have more weight in different circuits. So it's really the balancing of the measurements and then sub-campaigning it to the goal of your initiatives based on what brand has that priority. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, it's a huge difference. When I started in marketing at the operating level, it was a one-person show. Now we're building in-house agencies and creating revenue-generating models. We're partnering with heavy hitters in global agencies to make sure that our company brand and every brand within the family of companies are aligning and have that common core focus while still having their specialties.
So when you take a look at hospitality, and I use it as an example just because you talked about the ground floor versus the kind of the parent brand, right? If I look at Marriott as an example, and hopefully this isn't too far of an analog to where we're going in this business, is like Marriott, you know, has a whole portfolio of brands. Sometimes I don't even know that I'm staying at a Marriott, right? And they're coming up with new ones all the time. Like, is that gone too far? Do you see us going that way? We're beginning to sub-segment our markets, and you've got this parent brand, basically an Inc. like a Marriott, that's managing the life cycle of that customer throughout their journey. You know, it could be a student brand that migrates into a move-in brand, that moves into a townhome brand, into a SFR brand. Like, is that kind of where you see it going?
I do, and it has been. What's interesting, when I was with Realtor.com over 20 years ago, we morphed into Move.com, and we're really looking at the crossover journey between our demographics of home sales, new home sales, high-end versus renters in rural markets as well as major metropolitans. And it's really about meeting the customers where they're at to secure that loyalty. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Marriott, right? And we're looking at identifying, now that the classes are a little wider in the United States specifically, of how to build and maintain an approachable brand for the demographic that you're serving and catering to everything that they need. So you have your courtyards, right? You have your, and then you level it up along the way with your marquees and whatnot. But yet at the same point, you're able to bridge the gap and widen your circles to have those specialties and that knowledge point to say, okay, this is what I'm going to expect at the value. And that value is where I'm going to meet them. Or I'm looking for a very high-end experience. I need to decompress. Maybe I'm looking more for a wellness resort, and then I'm going to move towards the one or any of their other chains.
It is interesting. You know, I just saw you were on a student trip with one of your kids, and it's like, you go to a courtyard, you know what you're expecting. And I don't know if anybody really gets upset. I mean, I'm sure there's something to be said about along the way, but I know what I'm going to get. I know that I'm going to get the breakfast with the pancake maker on it and the hard-boiled eggs in the fridge and the yogurt and all that stuff. That's kind of in my mental mind. And I plan for that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're going to stay at a JW, I plan for something different.
Yes. You know?
And that's it's what I love about the brand in terms of a concept conversation is that it really is about expectations management, the brand promise, and then delivery. Because like, mm-hmm. I used to, if I go to a courtyard and the hard boiled eggs aren't there, I'm kind of upset.
That's your deal breaker.
It's my deal breaker. I was kind of planning.
We
for
all
that,
have them,
you know? And mm-hmm. and so like, that's kind of the thing. And so it's interesting to see this emerge. And I, you know, I foresee like maybe some complications in transition because you've got asset owners that are brand independent and operators that are brand forward that are going to like, you know, right now the shoes on the, or the tail wags the dog, so to speak, because we've got owners, they're just saying my sales experience, when I want to talk to getting, when I want to get something going, I'm finding I've got to pitch the owner and the owner activates the manager and then the manager implements because the owner has the NOI kind of like pinch point.
Yes.
Whereas like in hotel operations, the operator mandates what it, and they fire customers on the regular.
It is your core services. And I will say many management companies and operating companies do run differently. Some mm-hmm. are entirely empowered to make structural operating decisions at that regional level based on that regional portfolio. Like, and I don't want to speak out of turn. Anybody in the audience, correct me, but when I had previously worked with Graystar, they had independency in the Midwest. So the way that they operated in the Midwest was very different from their West Coast assets.
Interesting.
Still quality of service and standards, but maybe it was their software that wasn't the same or their mm-hmm. marketing strategies and things like that, where you do have other companies that say, these are our brand standards. As soon as we acquire an asset, our company floor mat is going in the lobby area. We change the signage and we move it along and we're flagshipping at that point. No matter what, you have to sell to all those people regardless, because if the site teams and the regional teams don't believe in the service, they're not going to adopt it. So your numbers are not going to be there.
Right.
But when it comes from the owner level, they are thinking more strategically, long-term partnerships. Maybe they're looking at the bandwidth for implementation a little differently. Either way can have success, but it's, you're selling to multiple layers throughout the organizations when you're selling to operating companies.
Interesting observation regarding the Midwest ops versus say West Coast ops.
Yes.
So given a forward-looking perspective, do you think that would have been an opportunity for a different brand going forward?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of times we'll regionalize flagships for the relevancy of what's going to speak to that audience. When growing companies in the past, from a vendor standpoint, we'd really look at the outside of the U.S. to grow and adopt our brands and then move into the Midwest, where they may not have that national buying power at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're seeing a lot more of the national companies come into there, and again in the South, and even the East Coast has been a little bit more implemented for some of the larger management companies out there. So rather than the smaller organizations or the market kings.
So it'll probably be a while before we have a White Lotus brand in multiple.
I just started binging that, and I don't know how I feel, especially in this business, because I think it's a little too relatable, even with the chaos serving the luxury market, as well as the obviously helping, hosting, employing, and training. It's a fascinating show, huh?
I mean, the third season,
no spoilers.
Yeah, I would say that the mortality rate would be a KPI we'd want to avoid.
We hope. Yeah.
So, I mean, going back to your article story, so it's interesting because I would have, of all the verticals, I probably wouldn't have picked student as a brand, as needing a brand first. I would have, I mean, and strictly because like my student experience, obviously like an era ago, and then like my kids being in post-secondary right now, like where does brand pay off in student, or why did you choose brand as a strategic lever when you guys launched Article? I mean, obviously it's kicking ass right now, but I'm just like, I'm curious.
Thank you.
Why that gap how that gap emerged.
Yeah, I think it's historical relevance and experience in the space that mm-hmm. when they first started, I think almost 20 years ago originally, I may be exaggerating that number just by a little bit, but they knew what they were doing. They really were founded in expertise. Mm-hmm. So to say, yes, this is how we need to operate and have these flagship brands. Mm-hmm. It also helps from a management standpoint when you can identify a property per region, per regional, or per ownership group. So that is beneficial. But then going to another opportunity I had in my career was with DTN Management out of Lansing, Michigan. And they started as a student company. And while they had individual names for the properties, all the properties were really branded and supported through that DTN brand. It was a family of companies and it carried a lot of weight. But what was interesting in that and being in East Lansing, Michigan, and those they had the market saturation, a lot of those students ended up carrying through the brand for their renter journey. So they would start in student, they'd do their master's, sometimes their doctorate. Then they would move into our conventional properties, even when they came into grad school or med school, and stay until they either went on to the next experience or stayed locally and continued to rent with us. So there was a lot of crossover with that. In being a regional market king, they had a lot of options in what Michigan had as metropolitan cities.
So when people take a look at like the churn numbers that are out there today, that are kind of like they've been around for a long time, and for those of us that are not from the industry, they just absolutely make us throw up because you just can't believe that people would turn over that often, that customers would turn over that often. When you take a look at that conversation you just had, that's a lifetime customer value conversation. So is that, do you see that as a very common kind of like mobilizing point or rally or even measurement for multifamily?
It's absolutely a measurement. You need to know where your people are coming from, right? Yeah. And especially when you're seeing migrational patterns, you're really looking at coming in from those shifts of employees. And generally your employee base and your new hires are a lot of times out of school, whether it be grad, whether it be medical, and you're watching those trends. So you definitely see where it comes. And of course it helps when you have a national footprint that can keep those residents within your portfolio and help them not only from their stay at your one individual community, but for their future community and ease that transitional plan.
Right. Interesting. So then, and how is it tracked typically?
All through our operating system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like when you hear about people talking about, like, it just doesn't get enough headlines, the lifetime customer value conversation. Because like when we take a look at churn, that obviously grabs a huge headline.
Yes.
But it feels as though in the churn conversation, there's very little reference to lifetime customer value.
We have a lot of strong student housing companies that specialize only in student housing. So they are really looking at that, their, you know, goal 40% renewal rate, which has been excellent. It definitely wasn't that way. I mean, in the even 5 years prior, we were satisfied with 27% renewed. But you know, you are going to lose your customer base at some point. So we're certainly tracking those years of what graduate till their graduation point. But when you're looking at companies that have those generational components and diverse asset classes, there is a true value in moving that conversation as well as starting it at the very beginning. So it is not once they go through their college experience, it is, if they have a great experience, and of course we hope they do, they're not thinking, okay, where else do I have to live? If they've had a great experience, they come to us and say, I have to give my notice to vacate. I had an offer here. Do you have anything here? Or we can help facilitate that conversation even with our partnerships or maybe even our ownership groups that we may not be managing those assets for, but they have a little bit more of saturation where they're going.
So is there kind of like a thinking around this cohort is exiting like their fourth or fifth year, however it's structured. And here at this point, we're going to begin to make them offers about, you know, staying with property management company XYZ that's across everywhere, you know, hey, if you're going to Atlanta, if you're going to Denver, if you're going to, you know, DC, here are the buildings that, you know, we think you'd be a perfect fit for, like that kind of positioning. That's happening.
Yes, absolutely. It's also, it may not always be happening in the front end with our offices. We hope that that's where they're thinking from, but sometimes staff turns as well as residents turn. So we also build that into our strategy when we have those multi-generational components from a digital standpoint to make sure that we are targeting that resident appropriately to give them the information that they need in their next step. So we do a little soft end and just maintain visibility from the marketing team. And then we hope that the sales team also comes in to close.
So Is that specific to student, or do we see that in other verticals, like other sub verticals?
I definitely have seen that between conventional housing and moving into the senior component or right. active living. When you have those, what's beautiful is when you're renting to a conventional renter, and say it's a middle-aged renter, they generally have a student that's either preparing for or in college mm-hmm. that may need student housing, but then they also have that aging parent that they're planning for. Mm-hmm. So we are not only servicing them in their current home, that we are helping find solutions for their entirety of their family and hopefully their friend base as well.
Wow. So when you take a look at like the problem that you're solving around brand, like how much of that is awareness, or do your customers typically already, or do you, you know, the people you've worked with in the past, or maybe your forward-looking market, or do they already know that this is a problem that needs to be solved, or is there an education element that you've got to kind of drip on them?
I think it really depends where each company is with their marketing department. When you work with a third-party partner, and they're very, very beneficial, but in my experience, there's always that balance. I don't always have the transparency of data I need to build those multi-generational plans, mm-hmm. or I have to make sure that I have the right partner that is going to identify and release those data points to our current performance to build that plan together. But it is a very interesting journey to read, especially when you're able to dial into those geographical points and life cycles.
Is it most of that marketing right now? Like to what degree do you see like social media playing an influence in that experience? Or do you see a role
massive
in influencers as well, like going that far?
You know, I have certainly used influencer marketing. One thing I have always done is I've been a beta person. So okay. even when 20 years ago, when I was with Realtor.com and social media was in the infancy, I was using my own social media to promote my business and what I needed to accomplish with it and doing that hybrid approach. But now, if we really have a successful social media strategy, and obviously much more adopted in student, but you have more platforms to manage, so it's where you're going to spend your time that's going to be most effective. Mm-hmm. I will say at Article, when I came on board and we had an incredible digital marketing manager, we brought a lot of our management in-house. And by doing that, we were able to really see those trends and make sure that we had those data points to make those decisions and have those crossovers. But social media, which may have been within the 7th to 10th top performing lead source out of all of them, we were able to cut that back, cut the majority of our ILSs, which is not uncommon, but use all that. And then social media became our number two lead source generator.
Really?
And when it comes from a cost per lead or a cost per lease, it is always the lowest from my experience when it's done well, done right, and the site teams right. are bought in.
And some might say that in student is probably naturally prone to social media, kind of like, you know, adoption versus other, you know, senior, maybe as an example.
It is, but not necessarily when you're looking at decision-making content. When you're really looking at those Facebook ads, it is the guarantors that are paying attention.
Sure.
Our TikTok had really taken off, and Instagram, and it really is about making sure the site teams are curating the content that they want to see while also promoting the product. So it's a delicate balance.
I find it interesting. And this is like my personal experience that, you know, so my oldest is in Pennsylvania and he's at an off-campus place. And of course, like the newsletters that come out are kind of funny because you read them, you know, I think just this weekend it was like, hey, reminder, no outdoor barbecues, right? No, you know, things like that. They're kind of like, yeah, well, you know, but then at the same time you get the parent, the guarantor is on the same mailing list as the students because we're all accountable. So for every lead, you really kind of get maybe 3 or 4 email addresses that you can market to.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And it is, again, it's a time component. It's a bandwidth component for how many people you have on your team. So when you have a stacked marketing team that is an internal agency or an external agency, they generally have the prioritization to look at those data points and build that custom content. So that way, if you are a guarantor, you're getting different information. You have a different website with a little more depth than what a student renter is going to want to look at. And we can break it down and drive the traffic that way.
Very, very sophisticated. And when you left, exited Article, what was the, How many beds did you guys have under management at that point in time?
Oh, I'm going to misquote it. I'm a god 90 days and really living that relaxed Florida life. So
how many zeros?
I know that we landed her right around that 42, maybe 44 properties.
Yeah.
I'd have to pull, but
what's that? That's
anybody on article listening. You want to throw it out there?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm giving it around 20,000
beds,
but I feel like it's probably more than that.
Yeah.
But they're very substantial. I think they broke the top 10 in student housing businesses in the country, specifically to the U.S. I mean, they're a force to reckon with.
It's impressive. I mean, considering that, like, it appears to me that it's a very fragmented segment, and you take a look at there's some of the big ones there, and to start a brand up and have that accomplish that kind of like the kind of conversion is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think that, like, my personal observation is the brand that you guys created with Article is much more it stands up. I won't say it's much more compelling. It stands
Thank
up.
Thank you.
Right. So good work on that, because it's certainly like it feels more like there's it just doesn't feel like a big huge conglomerate that's just pulling levers and, you know, doing turns.
And it's not. And that was the best thing about partnering with that group is the people were so dedicated, and a lot of them had grown up in the business. And Christopher Bartlett, who now leads the marketing department there, is a longtime employee, very intelligent, very, very dedicated. And it's exciting to see where they're going to take it, because what was launched and what's potentially on the market right now, I haven't looked, because I was excited to see the QuadReal brand revitalized rollout last week. But Article was just in phase two when I departed. So they have a lot more to come and certainly a lot to follow. It's exciting.
Outstanding. So when you take a look at the you're coming into, getting back into the Hell Yes side of things.
Yeah.
So like when you take a look at the problems that people are looking to solve, you know, and they seek brand. They consider brand as a solution, because, you know, you may not choose to invest in brand because it takes too long, or you believe it takes too long, or or you think that that's just not tangible or attributable or all those things. Like, how do you find people that are like, when you're thinking about your next chapter, or you're talking, you know, even retrospecting on your time at Article, and you had, because I mean, there's no doubt that you were internal selling all along the way, right? And in those internal sales pitches, maybe a good angle on that, those internal sales pitches, like, how are you, you know, surely there must have been objection along the way for some sort of budgetary items. And someone's like, you know, couldn't we try this 1, 2, 3? Couldn't we try these other ways? So like, what kind of objections would you get internally to versus a brand investment?
That is a great question, because in marketing and communications, there are always objections. You never get 100% agreement, because so much of it is emotional, and that's what we want to have happen. It all is really in how you're going to position it. But I'll say throughout my entire career, it is always an open conversation. It is not one person driving it. You're driving the process. You're not driving the outcome. So you want to make sure that you are taking people's concerns, building in the training, building in the language that needs to occur to get that brand adoption. And there are points. And a brand is something that should always be evaluated. Your values should always be evaluated. You're really looking at those your values really every year, but your brand itself every 2 to 3 years for future budgeting on when you're going to need to revitalize or refresh it. Mm-hmm. So when you're overcoming those objections, specifically on investment of time or investment of cost, you have to be prepared with what that ROI is going to look like. And it may not be you're having the full brand overhaul. It may not be you're creating a new piece. Sometimes it's to say, okay, then we're going to focus on the reputation management portion of this brand. And if I can get you here, here's where we're going to go, and we'll sustain in the current way of the current brand. Mm-hmm. But if it's not, this is when we need to invest, because we need to dissolve the past reputation in order to move forward. And a lot of times we'll do that with acquisitions or even when we're having a disposition and it's a flagship brand, we'll write in those times to say, okay, by this date, you have to change the brand in order to create the safety of our brand.
So then how do you cascade? So in that, I love that word disillusion or dissolve. Yeah. Like, how do you enforce the brand promise beyond the logos, the branding, the brand promise? Like, how do you bridge that gap? You talk about an acquisition, even when you're talking other regions. Mm-hmm. How do you activate that level?
That is such a good question. I love our conversations here, Mo. Because what's awesome is with what I've been doing, people think, okay, you're building the brand. You're telling them what to say. You're telling them how it needs to be. And a lot of that is, it's more of a training component. But sometimes when we launch a new brand, we're training and building this brand out with people that don't necessarily speak the same native languages. Mm-hmm. So we have to tailor those pieces and make sure the brand aligns. So then you're really fine tuning those guidelines. I think that's really important when you're getting people on board, that you have a process, that you're bringing people along on the journey of creation, because when you bring people along, you're going to get less objections at the end. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the pieces I've seen. I've done myself when I have created a company brand as an individual, or solely within the marketing team. And sometimes that has to be done just from a timing perspective. You know that you're going to have the fight of adoption internally as well as externally. You're not going to get that ramp up time digitally. So you're not going to have the relevancy. It is all just about how you're going to build that strategic plan for a rollout of adoption.
I can't remember if I had you comment on this article I was working on around competitive levers. And it was, it was specifically about centralizing maintenance. But like, one of the things that we talked that you know, I cite in that article was around like competitive value propositions. And so it was like, basically, do you compete on price? Do you compete on customer service? Do you compete on product innovation? And then brand is a lever for all three of those, but it's kind of like an amplifier. So when you take a look at brand, are people mostly trying to, what are they trying to solve? Like, what are they trying to get away from? Like, as an example, because like, I don't know if I'm framing the question properly. If we find ourselves in a competitive environment, we're competing on price all the time, then we're just in a race to the bottom, and or maybe regional vulnerability, or all those things. So you might want to lever on brand, because then you're going to be able to lever out the difference between, you know, the actual price to deliver that service and then the brand pickup or bonus or, you know, uptick, right? Because this is going to be a different experience and we're going to be done that way. How do you find in this world right now, where it feels very much so that we're competing on price, that you can begin to twist the conversation or at least bend the conversation to compete on something else that is amplified by brand?
Yeah. I always say it's never about price. And I'd say this back in my leasing days too. But coming from operating, it was never the price. If it was something that I really wanted and something I had planned for, I would find a way to find the money for it. Mm-hmm. And you're just looking for different efficiencies, but also you have to have that strategic plan to know what you're willing to bend for and what not, where you really want to go, what's going to impact your business. You know, when you're talking about those levers, it's always to say, okay, is it implementation? Is it timing? Not necessarily price. You know, do we have to pre-plan for these things? Mm-hmm. Or is there a misconception of value? And I love when you're talking about the competitive advantages. That was one thing I learned very early on in my career. And I think Ian said it in your last section of everybody talks about vertical integration, but it means different things to everybody. Everybody talks about centralization, but it means different things to everyone. And it's just talking to your clients to get a stronger understanding of their businesses and their challenges, so you can make that determination to help guide the conversation. And here's why this should be a priority. Or if price is your issue, are we beta-ing? You know, is there an opportunity to phase the roll up? Is there, You know, a lot of times vendor partners go for the whole portfolio. And I will tell you, I'm never someone that gives a whole portfolio unless it's already a decision I made 3 years ago. I'm always A/B testing. I'm always beta testing, especially when it comes to technology. Service is a little different. As you and I absolutely love maintenance services, very specifically because from a brand impact, they're my highest. They have the most influence on my reputation management. And that's a different conversation because I'm solving a challenge that they need when it is certain to understaffing and underperforming assets because those teams can't necessarily do everything we're asking for. And then I'm balancing, is it automation versus in-house management and software support and really looking at what will have the benefit long-term and what is not just a temporary solve.
Do you see that brand is becoming more and more of a conversation? So again, there's two threads that we're going to follow on. So this centralization conversation, you appreciate bringing it. I'll follow that one first. I do appreciate bringing that up because like I find the conversation of centralization has been everyone will say it's been overused and overadopted because like, if you compete on service as an example, centralizing people may not be the right strategy, but centralizing knowledge and process. If you look at Ritz-Carlton as an example, right?
Yeah.
It's a 6-week training program before you can even say hi to a guest, right? And we don't do that in this business, but like that is, or typically don't, but like that is something that is an element of centralization, right? It's centralized training, it's centralized, onboarding, and that's all part of their value proposition, how they want to compete on. They'll compete on price, they compete on service and experience. And so that part there is centralized. And so when you say maintenance centralization, it assumes that everyone's competing on price, but it's not really the case. If you're in a luxury, you're charging $15,000 a month for a unit, you should not take people off site. You should do everything you possibly can to keep them on site because you're competing on service, experience.
Guillermo, you just said the core of what I believe is the challenge in this entire industry, and it's training. Because people are investing now in marketing, and that took a while. That took a long time in my career. Then we're looking at maintenance, and then we're looking at asset strategies and how we can lean and have our systems and our data points talk to each other better. But it still comes down to, we are an industry where people are growing up in this space and not every company has a strong training company. So it comes with your hiring practices, if you do not have that, to bench your promotional rate or your intake rate of, we're going to promote 2 people up from within because we believe in empowerment and in bringing our people up. But then you have to have that external benchmark player to come in because they're going to have a different training, a different mindset than you previously had. But I do truly believe that the majority of our issues today would be solved with stronger training components outside of the management arm. Management arms tend to have the stronger amount of training. They have the responsibility for the bulk of employees. But when's the last time your investment team or your asset management team had a true training and development program other than a certification that they needed to have, you know? And direct leaders and executive leaders, with the volume that they're trying to accomplish, especially in high growth companies, don't always have the capacity or the experience themselves to train down, to train up. Right. And then you're talking layers, but maintenance specifically in the journey, you know, you may get a director of facilities, but I don't see a lot of executive team members outside of facilities role. And a facilities role is a lot different than those maintenance pieces along the way, or even the silos of the project management team. So then it gets pushed into construction. So that is a role specific journey that I'd love to see stronger training on rather than short-term troubleshooting or asset preservation pieces.
Mm-hmm. I mean, see, when I talk to folks that are kind of like bridging that gap from being on-site team members to maybe running a larger team, like I hear, vulnerabilities around the fact that they're all of a sudden being dropped into an Excel spreadsheet and they may or not have done budgeting before, right?
Correct.
Okay, you do your budgeting for this, maybe even just this building, right? Or this property. and they don't have any expertise in that. And so it's like, that's the job, granted, but how do you begin to bring them along so that they feel comfortable and they don't get like an anaphylactic reaction to being expected to do a budget that's going to be sent in an email to somebody who's going to evaluate the performance?
And that's part of your strategy internally, is to say, okay, as a leadership team, and a leadership team doesn't just mean the executive team. It means here's our commitment to develop these individuals and even just give them exposure to say, hey, I have to work on our department budget. Let's work on this together. Let me show you where some of the challenges are. Where are the cuts that we could potentially make? What do we need different this upcoming year? And then do it as a department function, not just as an individual. Mm-hmm. Or don't top down that, you know, because then you're going to miss a lot of pieces, especially when you're looking at technology or people specific, to say, we know we're not going to have this person. We know we're not going to fill this role again. What do we need to supplement that support? So that way, again, the customer journey isn't impacted, which in the long term impacts your brand negatively. It's a lot easier to have a good brand and sustain a good brand than have a negative impact, whether it's a short cycle or a one-time event, and build that brand back up.
True. And I guess the challenge there for people that are in the brand selling business is that the when something doesn't happen, like the impact on the attribution to positive events is kind of like how we do things. And then how do you prevent bad things from not happening? It's like selling safety or insurance, right? It's like we're in the business of things not happening, not in things of being, you know, of making things happen. And so it's kind of, is it hard to try and help people understand that, no, like the reason why you've got to do this way is so that things, bad things don't happen. Like, how is that get conveyed when you talk about the operational team members?
You have to look at your, I believe the majority of what we do can be anticipated. If we are looking at historical data and trends appropriately and not relying on a single source, as you had mentioned earlier, even just with searchability. So those things I think you can really look at and plan for. You know, mm-hmm. how many flood units you had one year, and maybe you're going to try to do some things to change that. And here's how you're going to switch your budgets to accommodate that. Or, you know, you had an excess of work orders and then still have, a project to where your maintenance supervisor is going to be monopolized because you're doing some rehabbed units and there won't be mm-hmm. additional support to help with that. So then you would have to hire somebody. Same with your leasing functions. If you're gonna renovate a project and 30% of that is gonna come online around the same time, you have to treat it just like a lease up from a marketing and sales function and make sure those calls and anybody interested is supportive and your website's responsive.
So how did it, given your tenure in this business, like what percentage, what's the adoption of brand in the business from your perspective, ballpark?
I cannot speak to that because I throw it out there and be like, this is what I expect. Yeah. I will say internal brand adoption, I'm looking at 80%. I'm over the moon with 90%, but you're always going to have those people that don't believe that the brand is authentic because of their direct employment experience. Or even from a ownership investment, right? It may be that this doesn't align, but it's a long-term partnership. So they're not bought into your brand, but they're bought into your performance. Mm-hmm. And from a resident journey, the brand is more about the team and experience that they are receiving on site than it is anywhere else. And so that, when you're looking at adoption, again, I'm going to track those by the renewal rates and that brand mm-hmm. loyalty and those year-over-year performance numbers. And in conventional, it's been beautiful. We've been seeing it up in the 60%. And, you know, when we're looking at student, we're thrilled to see those numbers climbing over 40%, which, mm-hmm. as I mentioned earlier, are quite unheard of, but have been consistency for the past few years.
Yeah, especially when they have to exit, right?
Yes.
They ultimately graduate, right? So they're mm-hmm. going to be moving out. Interesting. When you're talking about that, like what, like, you know, of the overall rental industry, right? How many of them are using brand as a competitive lever? Like what percentage there?
Again, I don't speak to data if I don't feel I'm accurate on it.
Sure, and fair enough.
So I can give you some generalization, but when I think of brand loyalty, even just in my career and my renter experience, there was a lot of weight to it. Granted, I'm in the business, but you know, when I look at those calls that came out of people knowing I'm in the business and they needed to rent an apartment and wanted my thoughts on this, I think there are a lot of companies that do it incredibly well. I will say it generally tends to be the ones with the largest pocketbooks and the largest asset largest asset classes. But I'm really quite impressed with some of the market kings and even the smaller companies saying, we need a great experience now. You know, we may have 10, 20 properties, but it is easy for us to manage operationally if we have those brand standards and, and people are bought into staying here. You know, it affects everything, but truly that training component and leaders emulating that brand and reiterating that brand in every single thing that they do and the core values, that's what makes it really different.
Well, and I think that the opportunity for brand, given that this industry is like physically disaggregated, right? And people are everywhere and we've got to make decisions fast. The one thing that, you know, while it may feel really imposing to try and think through what a brand might mean, the one thing that I've seen and witnessed this in my experience is that like having a brand that can be repeated by everybody else creates, it liberates managers. It actually relieves micromanagement because they know what the right thing is to do because that's the brand. And it's been reinforced over and over and over again. So, I mean, at least in my experience, deploying brand means that doesn't mean that you're, you know, showing everyone how to tie their shoes. It does mean that, but they do know that tying their shoes is important. It's a terrible analogy, but I hope you can appreciate that, or that safety is important, or at least that the look and fit of a person is important, right? Like,
and you have the process alignment. You have the same crisis response plans. Mm-hmm. You have the same training. You have the same acting moments for acquisitions, dispositions. You have the same core structures. Sometimes they have to deviate. We always have to deviate, you know, with say even new development plans. But you still know that the mile markers are the same and the expectations of the company are the same at everywhere with every role.
And that consistency across all of them makes it easier for everyone to understand what their career path might look like.
Completely. And they know when they have to short-term help another property that they know what's expected to them, that it is clear and transparent and everybody has the same data sets. They may not have the same KPIs or goals, but you know what needs to get done to get there. And you know you're not alone. I think that's the best part of having a strong infrastructure and process plan. And even when you're looking at your SOPs, making sure that that is written for the entirety of your audience and not just the executive team or the department that's writing that process, so it can truly be understandable. And that's part of your brand as well.
I think it's funny to kind of think about it It's interesting to think about it this way. And this is kind of like my kind of like interpretation of our conversation today. And my experience is that like the effort to put in a brand, if you don't invest in brand, then that's your brand, right? Like if you don't invest in safety, then you may be an unsafe place to work. If you don't invest in an experience, then the experience is kind of, it's like the Alice in Wonderland thing. Like if you don't decide where you're going to go, you might just end up there.
Well, I do love Alice in Wonderland. You hit on my Disney theme and my art collection with Dolly, but it is, you have to know where you're going. And when we build a brand, and even if we include everybody in the decision-making and get lots of feedback along the way and create it based off feedback, it shifts. It may not be what we originally intended. So if we're still force-feeding what was intended rather than what it's morphed into, and a brand doesn't, it kind of comes down to when I used to consult and had to talk with companies to reset their current structure. If they can't tell me in 5 seconds what the value of their company is, and it's that short-term elevator pitch, right? Mm-hmm. But everybody said the same crap. Sorry, but you know, it's the same thing. And I'm like, well, how's that going to benefit? Like, what makes you different is mm-hmm. what I want to know. How are you better for me than anything else or anywhere else that I'm looking at in speaking that language?
So as a takeaway for everyone listening today and kind of down the road, like, how can they, like, how could someone do a litmus test on their brand today?
I think you look at your adoptions. I think you know if you are underperforming or overperforming, but the first key KPIs that I look at is your reputation, where mm-hmm. you're sitting with that, because that's external and internal. Then I'm going to look at your attrition rates, because that's your employment rates. Mm-hmm. And that's how many people want to stay with you, how many people are growing with you, but how many people are leaving you and why. And then I'd be looking at your growth. Are you hitting your growth targets? Are you bringing in new investment partners? Are you retaining investment partners? So those three things: reputation management, obviously asset performance, but company attrition, and then company growth.
And then what if they decide that brand isn't important this quarter or next quarter? What happens?
It's not saying there's always a piece that is important that's a priority to someone on the board. So it's getting people to understand that brand isn't just the logo and what you see digitally on marketing or physically at the properties. That your brand is all the way through your expectations and how you're processing and operating. And so it is the totality of your performance.
Yeah.
So we have to talk through that. Usually by the time somebody would reach out to me in my career, it's because they either had a really, really aggressive trajectory that they weren't confident that they could hit. Maybe they were looking at having too wide of a target and had needed to dissolve their third party. But a lot of times it's starting to say, we're not where we want to be. We don't know what we want to be, but we know we don't like what we are. And those are always the start of the conversation. So it's as simple as, are you satisfied with your company if it stayed this way for the next 5 to 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, what would you change?
What would you change?
Mm-hmm. And everybody always says, we have the best people. Well, then what's great about those people and what are you doing to make them that great? And that's when we can kind of identify the things that people don't always want to look at.
Yeah.
Especially in those long tenured family companies.
Yeah. Well, I had a startup. This is like years ago. And what we did was we measured the, as an example, just in terms of like, why are people staying? We measured the tonality of chat messages in like the intercompany chat.
Oh yeah.
And so the idea was that we'd actually figure out if there's negative tonality within certain parts of the hierarchy versus like positive tonality in other parts of the hierarchy, just to see if people are speaking with like with positive language and not so much like, not concession, but like, are they affirming? Are they seeking to understand, or are they judging and and dropping? And it was interesting to see when you think about like why people are staying, how that relates to performance, is that you can find pockets of toxicity that begin to kind of permeate, and it can be routed. It can be mapped very quickly to that leader. We take a look at the triangle, and there's a pocket of toxicity or negative language, and high churn within a specific part of that triangle, that leadership triangle, and you just go to the top, and then you start seeing where that behavior can is being tolerated, right? Where negativity gets tolerated, and so then by virtue of the fact that it's not being admonished, it becomes rewarded.
Oh, you're speaking my language from a communication standpoint, Guillermo, that a lot of people don't look at. And it's that your brand doesn't have a singular voice, especially when you're working with people that are to execute and emulate your brand. And when you're looking at an executive structure and that visibility plan, your president is not going to speak on or speak to or at the same language than what your COO may speak at. So you mm-hmm. really have to tailor the structure of your quote and your brand voice for that individual to not only have a personal brand, but make sure that personal brand aligns with it, or else you have every single person communicating the same language, which can be good, but it's not them. So you have to be able to build a plan for them that aligns with your corporate structure.
Outstanding. Very cool. So people that are looking to What are you giving us the direction in terms of what to take a look at if you want to test your brand right away? So it was retention, it was your people churn, and then your reputation. People that are looking to kind of like to dig in on this, what are they? I'm going to go with this one. What are they? How can they reach out? Like, how can they? What should they be looking for in Google? Like, they're probably not typing in brand, but what should they be thinking about when they're looking at changing something?
What is so good, and you mentioned it earlier in this, that we're no longer singular. We're no longer having to answer questions ourselves and dig deep ourselves. So any decision-making I have and I'm looking into, or any plan that I'm creating, I'm going to use AI. I'm going to use Google searching in multiple ways. And then I'm going to test my industry experts to say, is this what you're seeing? And then read the commonalities of those data points or those planning and build off that. And then that will tell my story and where I need to go. Originally searching, depending on the problem, say it's brand adoption, which can oftentimes be lead generation. So let's just take it there. Then you're looking at what properties are performing the best in my market. And that's more of an AI search and then a Google search specific to that city and state. And then you're going to see all that relevancy, and then you're going to see the ILSs you can dig into and whoever is doing PPC and has strong SEO. And then also just word of mouth. But benching all those three ways of searches for those common points gives you a starting place to dig deeper.
Wow. What a wonderful data centered conversation today. Really appreciate it. I just love it. So it's awesome in that, like, I mean, marketing gets a bit of a bad rap in terms of, like, you know, the saying, like, 50% is working. I don't know which 50%, but I just love your
I have not heard that, but that's
really
hilarious.
But I just love the data centricity of the conversation and the approach to work. Cause it adds conviction to the recommendations, adds conviction to the outcomes. And just, like, you know, it is something that creates a tremendous amount of value for companies, and it's underinvested or under prioritized. And when it does work, it just is it's a rocket ship. And it's awesome to see.
We're known for spending money, and I'm not going to say that I'm much different, but I always have a why. And as long as I have the why, people will get behind it and support it, or I'm going to figure out how I can build the why into what they're looking for and go from there. But without data and historical information, and also direction for an organization, it's just an ask without anything behind it. So
it's very vulnerable. Excellent. Well, how can people get a hold of you if they want to chat more?
I say hit me up on LinkedIn. We're on LinkedIn Live today. I'm sure I'm attached to this. My cell's on there, my email's on there, but please don't hesitate to reach out. I'm always open to the conversation. If we have any questions come through, Guillermo and I will have a follow-up for you, but this is so fantastic. I always love our conversations, and I'm so grateful to be a part of it. But again, no agenda today other than a great conversation, and it certainly was.
Well, I appreciate all the insights. I hope it was valuable for me, and just to help understand the impacts, the drip layer of brand on everything that you do from an operations perspective, and how that all comes together. Very appreciated on that. The data centricity, it's not a magic black box. There's data behind it. And you've got to, you know, start making decisions with data so that you can measure your decisions with data. And then ultimately, you know, the amplifier that it can affect the type of strategy you take as a company, how you want to win, right?
Completely.
Perfect. And who should we talk to next?
Oh, you talked to some of my favorites already. We already talked about Ann and Joe. I'd say to see some of the great work that was done, my partners at Article were really Erica White, is an extremely influential person in the student space, running their technology, innovation, and strategic initiatives at Article. She is a force, but also Terry Keeble, who was our past president, can really speak to how to lead in those times of change. And he was amazing at giving me the autonomy to run and also pumping the brakes when I am a little too enthusiastic. Outside of that, and as we're talking specific to sales and industry, I'd say some of my biggest influences in my career from that front really falls back to like Lisa Trozine, Jamie Gorski, Kate Good, and having some of those team members on as well.
Right on. I'll reach out to all of them to see how they're doing. Eric and I did chat a while back, and she is a force. There's no doubt about that. So
incredible. What her and Whitney Kidd are doing with the W Collective and also for their own companies. And Whitney Kidd is another one. Yep. Certainly so many wonderful people in our industry that would love to have this conversation.
I can't wait for it. Thank you very much for those extra leads. And thank you for listening today. I appreciate you guys tuning in and listening. And there will be the podcast we published in about a week or so. Blog will come out. There'll be other content that comes out. If you have any questions about what we chatted today, feel free to shoot either of us a link or comment even on the LinkedIn Live. I'll both get a notification for that. Thank you, Jacqueline, so much for all of our conversations, your friendship, and I just appreciate everything that you're doing out there today.
Thank you so much. And I will see and talk to you soon.
See you soon. Take care,
everybody.
Everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, we're good.